optimal minimal.
At this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking.
Can I answer your personal question?
Now would have seemed an appropriate time.
What if I did the opposite?
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
The Tim Ferriss Show.
This episode is brought to you by Laird Superfood. I love this company. I love their products. I just got a huge box delivered yesterday for a re-up because I always keep it in stock. And many of you have asked me about intermittent fasting, so I'll touch on that in a second. Founded by big wave surfer Laird Hamilton, I mean, really one of the kings of big wave surfing, and volleyball champion Gabby Reese, Laird Superfood promises to deliver high-impact fuel to help you get through your busiest days. And I can speak from experience, having worked out with both Laird and Gabby. These are people you want to emulate. They are just incredible physical specimens, and their combination of performance and longevity is unlike perhaps anything I've ever seen elsewhere. Laird Superfood offers a line of plant-based products designed to optimize your daily rituals from sunrise to sunset. My favorite two products that I put in just about everything are their turmeric superfood creamer and the unsweetened superfood creamer. And a $10 bag of either of these will last you a really long time. So the bang for the buck is incredible. Both can really optimize your daily coffee or tea ritual. I really put them in any warm beverage that I make for myself. And that's where the intermittent fasting comes in. So if I'm going to skip meals, I really like to use some of either the unsweetened or the turmeric superfood creamer. They are packed with, among other things, a full range of MCTs, that's medium chain triglycerides, to help keep you and your brain going from AM to PM. So that's part one. They're also packed with real ingredients like organic extra virgin coconut oil, coconut milk, and aquamin, and they come in all sorts of flavors, including cacao and, as I mentioned, turmeric. You just have to stir them. You don't really need any instrument for that. You can just do it with a spoon. You could power froth if you have a little frother, or blend otherwise into your cup of coffee, for instance, for a nourishing and energizing superfood latte you can feel good about using to kickstart your day. It's also, for me, an affordable indulgence, right? Because black coffee, I love black coffee, but after having 1,000 cups of black coffee at home, I just want a change. And so to feel like I'm having a decadent cappuccino of sorts, plus brain fuel on top of that, really can make the difference in winning the morning for me. So Laird Superfood, they understand that food is fuel, and the better fuel you have, the harder and further you can go. This is an easy and inexpensive way to really add some octane to your mornings and amplify your daily rituals. They have a diverse product line, including superfood creamers, as I mentioned, the two that are my favorite, turmeric and unsweetened, delicious hydration solutions, and much more. For a limited time, Laird Superfood is offering you guys, my listeners, 20% off of your order when you use code TIM at checkout. Check out LairdSuperfood.com. That's LAIRD. LairdSuperfood.com/Tim to see my favorite products and learn more. Again, that's LairdSuperfood.com/Tim and use code TIM for 20% off of your order. One more time, take a look. I use this stuff all the time and I recommend trying it out. LairdSuperfood.com/Tim, promo code TIM. This episode is brought to you by 5-Bullet Friday, my very own email newsletter. It's become one of the most popular email newsletters in the world with millions of subscribers, and it's super, super simple. It does not clog up your inbox. Every Friday, I send out 5 bullet points, super short, of the coolest things I've found that week, which sometimes includes apps, books, documentaries, supplements, gadgets, new self-experiments, hacks, tricks, and all sorts of weird stuff that I dig up from around the world. You guys, podcast listeners and book readers, have asked me for something short and action-packed for a very long time, because after all, the podcast, the books, they can be quite long. And that's why I created 5-Bullet Friday. It's become one of my favorite things I do every week. It's free, it's always going to be free, and you can learn more at tim.blog/Friday. That's tim.blog/Friday. I get asked a lot how I meet guests for the podcast, some of the most amazing people I've ever interacted with. And little known fact, I've met probably 25% of them because they first subscribed to 5-Bullet Friday. So you'll be in good company.
It's a lot of fun. 5 Bullet Friday is only available if you subscribe via email. I do not publish the content on the blog or anywhere else. Also, if I'm doing small in-person meetups, offering early access to startups, beta testing, special deals, or anything else that's very limited, I share it first with 5 Bullet Friday subscribers. So check it out, tim.blog/Friday. If you listen to this podcast, it's very likely that you'd dig it a lot. And you can, of course, easily subscribe anytime. So easy peasy. Again, that's tim.blog/Friday. And thanks for checking it out, if the spirit moves you.
This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I get asked all the time what I would take if I could only take one supplement. The answer is invariably Athletic Greens. I view it as all-in-one nutritional insurance. I recommended it, in fact, in the 4-Hour Body. This is more than 10 years ago, and I did not get paid to do so. With approximately 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food-sourced ingredients, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense and comprehensive formula on the market. It has multivitamins, multi-mineral greens complex, probiotics and prebiotics for gut health, an immunity formula, digestive enzymes, adaptogens, and much more. I usually take it once or twice a day just to make sure I've covered my bases if I miss anything I'm not aware of. Of course, I focus on nutrient-dense meals to begin with. That's the basis. But Athletic Greens makes it easy to get a lot of nutrition when whole foods aren't readily available. From travel packets, I always have them in my bag when I'm zipping around. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving my audience a special offer on top of their all-in-one formula, which is a free vitamin D supplement and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription purchase. Many of us are deficient in vitamin D. I've found that true for myself, which is usually produced in our bodies from sun exposure. So adding a vitamin D supplement to your daily routine is a great option for additional immune support. Support your immunity, gut health, and energy by visiting athleticgreens.com/TFS. You'll receive up to a year's supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your subscription. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/TFS, as in Tim Ferriss Show. athleticgreens.com/TFS.
Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. Not only is Bluehost Cloud our fastest web hosting available, but it's also built for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Hello, boys and girls, ladies and germs. This is Tim Ferriss. Welcome to another episode of The Tim Ferriss Show, where it's my job to interview people who are the best at what they do, or certainly world-class performers. And my guest today is Sydney native. We're going to talk about Sydney. Jim Jefferies. Jim is one of the most popular and respected comedians of his generation, entertaining audiences, including yours truly, around the globe with his provocative, belief-challenging, and thought-provoking comedy. I would underscore the thought-provoking. He created and starred in the sitcom Legit and the Comedy Central late-night show, The Jim Jefferies Show. Jim was honored as Stand-Up Comedian of the Year at the Just for Laughs Festival in summer 2019. At the end of 2019, he embarked on his new tour, Oblivious, touring all around Europe and North America. He is currently working with NBC on a multi-camera pilot, which he will star in from writer-producer Suzanne Martin, Sean Hayes, and Todd Milliner's Hazy Mills and Universal TV. His new podcast, I Don't Know About That, debuts on Tuesday, May 5th. You should check it out. And his 9th, count them 9, that's incredible, stand-up special will be released later this year on Netflix. You can find him on all the socials at Jim Jefferies. That's J-E-F-F-E-R-I-E-S. And jimjefferies.com. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tim. Tim Ferriss, that's a very good Australian name. I'm sure you get that a lot, right?
I do, actually.
You know, like the guitarist from NXS, you obviously know that, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
I have a Tim Ferriss story.
Let's hear it.
I was performing at the Enmore Theatre in Sydney, And Tim Farris came backstage at my gig, and I was like, I was a kid from Australia, very excited to meet the guitarist from NXS, and I think he wrote most of the songs as well, you know. And when I saw him, he just had like his finger had fallen off. Like it'd been like, I think it was a boating accident or something. His finger had been ripped off. And I was like, wow. So he goes, yeah, that's the end of NXS. I can't really play guitar anymore because I can't, you know, play the chords because I don't have this finger anymore. And I went, that's a shame. And so, you know, I said, so it turns out your finger was more vital than Michael Hutchins because, you know, NXS, I think, had three new singers and they kept going. But you lose Tim Farris's finger and they can't play anymore.
Well, that is the first separate Tim Farris anecdote that has ever happened in 400 plus episodes. So I'm thrilled. You know, I've had that name pop up before, the comparison, but I've never heard an actual story. So that's
he's a very nice man. It was the Farris brothers. They all went to there was my school, and then there was the school next to us, and we had a rivalry with them. And our school was like, we beat you in rugby, and they're like, we had NXS, and we were like, you win. Yeah, that's the most famous person to come from my school, I think, is me. You know what I mean? Like we haven't got a great track record. So hello to all the people at St Ives High in Sydney. That's where I went. But we had me, I think, a couple of people who got like bronze in the Olympics and some relief pitcher for the Angels back in the 90s.
Well, let's talk about Sydney. I have actually spent a fair amount of time there. I rented an apartment with a friend in Woolloomooloo. And
that's a bit of money. It's where the Prime Minister lives.
Well, you know, it was his idea. Although I will tell you the drawback. And you can probably tell me what these birds are. You have the most beautiful white birds that make the most god-awful sounds.
Oh, imaginable. Australian women. Yeah. I know what you're talking about. Good looking, but the accent's fucking horrendous. Yeah. No, I've met them in me day. Oh, yeah, I'm enjoying that. Keep doing it. Oh, yeah, that feels good. Yeah, no. The worst accent for sex in the world is the Australian female. But what bird are you talking about?
There's some protected bird. I want to say maybe it's a macaw. It's this white bird. It has this plume on its head, and it sounds
it's a galah. A cockatoo.
Cockatoo. Yes.
Yeah, a cockatoo. Okay, I'll tell you. My father's like, he's like this guy that he's at one with animals for whatever reason, and he has this like our veranda. He opens up the doors, and each day these two rainbow lorikeets come and visit my father, and they fly in the window and they just sit on his shoulders. Now, cockatoos look very exotic here in America, but they're everywhere in Australia. They're not endangered at all. They're all over. My dad thinks they're a pest, right? And he goes, there's a cockatoo that bothers those two rainbow lorikeets. So my father keeps a slingshot and some rocks by the side of his chair and he shoots the cockatoos when they come over. And my friend, my American friend who co-hosts my podcast with me, Forrest, was there, and he goes, does it kill him? He goes, no, it just gives him a bit of a scare. You know, if it hit one of them in the eye, you know, why were you in Sydney for so long? Were you just backpacking or?
I was there because one of my best friends is actually a Kiwi, was living in Sydney at the time, and he invited me to head over. And separately, the Australian edition of my first book was launching in Sydney, and they wanted me to show up for a handful of media gigs and this, that, and the other thing. And so I combined everything together and stayed for two and a half weeks. It probably only took me two and a half minutes to get my pale scalp annihilated by your ozone-free sun. It's intense.
People don't know that. There's two holes in the ozone layer, and one's over, I think the North Pole, I think, or it might be the South, and the other hole's over Australia. And Australia, when you watch like okay, so when you watch the weather here in America, it'll go, and the temperature's going to be this, the humidity's going to be this, and there's some winds coming in from over here. But you never get the daily UV rating. Where in Australia, they go, and it's 100% UV today. And it's like 100% is like normal thing. So it's like you don't even really think about skin cancer that much in America. Like, you know it happens and you have to be wary of it. And if you have a mole, you get it checked and that type of stuff. But skin cancer, if it's not number one, it's very close to the number one cancer in Australia. And so we had a slogan when I was a kid called slip, slop, slap. And it was slip on a shirt, slap on sunscreen, and slap on a hat. And that's how what you have to do if you want to go outdoors. And now the kids today in Australia, if you're at school, they have a policy called no hat, no play. You can't go out of the classroom if you're not wearing a hat, and the hat will have like one of those things down the back. So it covers your neck as well. It's a good look.
Well, if you go to Bondi, maybe not Bondi, I'm not sure where the best surfing beaches are, but if you go to some of these beaches, I was astonished because I saw all the surfers look like they were getting ready for an Antarctic expedition. I mean, they had the ear flaps, the neck flaps, they had enough zinc on their face to make them look like snowmen.
We always had like fluorescent zinc on our noses as kids in the 80s, and now they still just put the white stuff. But that was how you sort of showed how your personality, whether you had pink or green or fluoro yellow or whatever like that. But I like to look at like Bondi Beach and just watch the British people who have never seen sun, just like, and you know they've been there for a week going, go on there, lay out. Enjoy yourself. And they're all just getting burnt the fuck. Yeah. I love watching the British get burnt in Australia.
Well, I suppose Bondi, if I remember correctly, because my friend used to be a lifeguard, actually, and he was saying you could just sit at a cafe and you could watch, I suppose, on one hand, the Brits just get turned into rotisserie chicken. And then you could see tourists from, he said in particular, from China just get swept out to sea because they weren't prepared for the currents.
I mind you, when I was a kid, that happened to me a few times when you swim out a bit far and then you start drifting off and you're like, ah, fuck, I'm going to die. I did that thing where I waved and then like someone has to come out the little boat and come and get you. And you're like, sorry about that. I swam a bit far. You know, so to this day, I don't go far out in the ocean, you know.
When did you feel confident in comedy as your direction? Actually, before we get to that, let's bookmark that question. I just want to say something before I forget. Sure. And not to get all sentimental this early on our first date, but I owe you a debt of gratitude because your comedy has helped me get through some really dark periods. And that might sound funny because your comedy itself can be dark at points. But putting that aside, I've really enjoyed your comedy over the years, and it's been not just entertaining, but really helpful to me at points. So thank you for that.
Oh, no problem. That's a very sweet thing of you to say.
And so to comedy and direction, when did you feel confident that was your...
I wanted to be a comedian from the age of about 13, 14, you know, and then I did it three times when I was 17, and one time I did it and it went really well. And it was the Comedy Store in Sydney, and you have to go down there and they put your name in a hat and they pull your name out. And I had 5 minutes, and it was just all about being in school or whatever. I can't even remember what I talked about. And then they said, "Oh, you're not 18, are you?" And I was like, "No." And they go, "You have to come back with a parent." And so I hadn't told my parents, and my parents as well, I hadn't even told them that I went into the city. Like, I wasn't allowed to go into the city. You know, I lived out in the suburbs, and I told them I went to a mate's house or something. So I traveled into the city. And so next time my dad had to come with me, and I remember it was like bucketing down with rain, and I went out there and I got back on, and the only other people in the audience, because it was raining, were the other comedians waiting to go on. And there was the full range of people who were getting good at it, people who were never going to get good at it, and people who are their first go, and people have been trying for years. And anyway, I couldn't have had a worse gig. I couldn't have died worse than that. And I got in the car with me dad afterwards, and me dad said, he goes, "Oh, you're a good kid and you got a lot of good qualities, but this isn't for you." And my heart sank. And I went and did it one more time just to see, because that first time went so well. And then I did it again and I died again. And I went, "All right, this isn't for me." And then I didn't go up again until I was 20. I didn't do it. Yeah, I waited another 3 years. I used to think it was more than that, but I was in college and I used to run my own comedy night. And I remember I was in Perth when I started doing that. So a lot of people think I'm from Perth because of this, because I really started doing comedy in Perth. But the way that a lot of people get stage time is what you do is you find a venue, you put your own shows on, you book your own comedians, and that way you can MC and you can get better by, you know, because I couldn't get gigs, so I thought I'd run my own gig. And there was this area in Perth called Claremont, and Claremont had a serial killer, at the time. The had the Claremont killer, right? So what happened? I don't think they ever caught him. I don't know. But maybe they did catch him. I don't know. But when I was there, the guy called the Claremont killer. And what happened was with the Claremont killer, all the bars that were normally, this was a big party area of Perth, they were all, no one was going out because all the girls who got killed, the last thing that happened for them, they left the nightclub and got into a taxi or went looking for a taxi, and then they were never seen again. So that nightlife there just died. So there was all these like bars that were just empty. And so I went into one like, oh, can I have a gig? You know, like that. And they were just happy to have anyone in the building. And I used to get like 15 people, me mates, to come along to these shows. And it was like a really popular bar. But on a Friday night, I could have a gig there because of the killer. So, you know, silver lining to what happened there.
And when you, if we go back to 17, you tried it three times. Maybe this isn't for me. What in your head was plan B? Or the alternative?
Well, there's a weird thing that sort of, I think there's a, you know, for people who really know about me, and that's not many people, but there's a bit of a myth about me being an opera singer, which is vaguely true, right? What happened was when I was 17, I was in a school musical. And then I was doing all right. And then someone said, oh, you should get some singing lessons and blah, blah, blah. And so I got some singing lessons with this guy called Richard Gill, who has since passed. And he was one of the main conductors for the Sydney Opera. And he got me a part in the chorus of Wagner's The Flying Dutchman. And I had to sing in German. I was like 17 and I just sang. I just bought a CD of this opera and I just mimicked it, you know. And I wasn't that great a singer, but after that I got into WAPA, which is the West Australian Academy of Performing Arts. And I studied musical theatre and then I studied opera in the next year. And so I was a professional opera singer for a few weeks of my life, but it was never a full-blown thing. But I did this course. It was the same course that Hugh Jackman did. And it was it was a full scholarship ride. And I remember because I didn't have the marks in school to get into anything academic in university. And I don't believe I had the marks to actually get into this course, but they never checked for my high school certificate. And I just went in and did a dance and singing audition and stuff. And I always still wanted to be a comic, but because I thought the comedy wouldn't work out, I still wanted to be an entertainer and a performer. So I thought, oh, this is another thing I can do. And it was also, I think for my mother at that stage, that was something that she was far happier to brag about, that I was studying music in a prestigious college or something like that. But on maybe my second year into the course, there was a comedian called Gary who was like this guy who'd been on Australian TV. I still know Gary to this day. He's a very nice man. And he'd come over to do a gig in Perth and I was his opening act and we had a few drinks afterwards. We got along. I think he liked me more as a person than he liked me as a comic. But he said, do you want to come and do these mining town gigs? And I thought, ah, that's too good an opportunity. So I quit university and I went out to like places like Kalgoorlie and these little gold mining towns. And I performed in these bars just to like Australian cowboys, pretty much like guys in cowboy hats that live out in the land and they work in the mines and all that type of stuff. These towns had so many men working out there and so few women that in the bars in these towns, the bartender would be a female and they'd ship them in. And they'd call them skimpies, and a skimpy, and she would just be topless. Now, this wasn't a strip bar. This was just a normal bar. All the bars have topless bartenders in all these little country towns. And the reason for that is if you take away the topless girl behind the bar, it's a gay bar. it's just men. So they had to go, no, we're not gay, because they all dress like cowboys, just on the thing. No, we're not gay. There's a pair of tits over there, so we're all right, you know. And so I did these gigs and I thought, and I hadn't told my parents that I'd quit university. I thought, you know, I thought I'll just keep doing this until I can be a full-time comic. And then I think it's basically the storyline of the movie Punchline, that Tom Hanks character who said, oh no, I'm going to be a doctor. And then he said he'd tell his parents once he's a professional comic. But then I just quit uni. I went back to Sydney to my parents and said, oh, I'm going to give stand-up comedy a go. And then I think I moved to England. Oh, I moved to England then. I know the day I moved to England because I was packing my suitcase and at about 10 o'clock at night, and I was all excited. It was going to be my first time traveling overseas. I'd never been – oh, no, tell a lie. I'd been to America once when I was 14, but it was my first time traveling overseas by myself without family members, yeah? And I was going on my big adventure by myself. I was getting on a plane and I was packing my bags and the Twin Towers fell down. And that's how I can remember the date that I left for Britain, the next day, yeah.
Now, you leaving to Britain, I had read, trying to do homework for this conversation, that sure. you'd commented somewhere that there were lots of funny comics in Australia, some people funnier than you, but you had more ambition than some of them, and you ended up going to the UK. You ended up then going to the US. Is that a misquote? I mean, you can't believe everything you read on the internet.
I think that's true, but it maybe more ambition is the wrong way to say it. I think I was in a place in my life where I was young enough and had less connections that I could get up and do that, you know? I didn't have a girlfriend. I didn't have kids, you know? And I started pretty early in life at comedy, and a lot of people don't start till, you know, they're 30 or they're late 20s or whatever like that, and then they have roots, you know? And I didn't have anything holding me back. So there were comics in Australia who were better than me, but I feel like maybe they couldn't get up and go. But also, when I say ambition, there's a difficult thing with Australian comedy, because doing live work in Australia is very difficult because you don't have the population to sell tickets. People watch comedy in Australia, but they only go out and see the big acts when they come to town. So the comedy clubs, for the most part, are empty. And Melbourne has one comedy club. Sydney, I think, has two. Perth has one. This isn't enough to sustain an industry, you know, a ground roots industry anyway. And so everybody's sort of like, when you've made in Australia, you're the breakfast radio guy. If you can get that job, and that job in Australia pays really, really well. And so everyone's trying to get those jobs. So I think a lot of people who were good comics maybe had, because no one was really full-time, maybe had a good day job. I didn't have a good day job. I was selling mobile phones during the day when I was a comic in Australia. So I fucking wasn't worried about leaving that at all. I was one of the worst employees a company had ever had. And I worked for a place called Strathfield Car Radios. And I was just, if there was a way to get out of working, I had found it. There was stairwells that I hid under, and I did things that seemed like to get out of work that were more work than actually doing work, you know. If I had to sell car stereos and mobile phones, and it was, you know, I still to this day, if I was to sell a car stereo, I don't know how much amplifiers you need to run a subwoofer, and I sold them for years. And I have no idea. Well, I was at college, I worked for this guy. And I used to just point at things and guess and go, look at the size of it and go, that'd do it, you know. One time I totaled a guy's white van, like just totaled it, just in a stereo fitting, which is very – what happened was this guy, this white van driver, a guy that, you know, works, a plumber or whatever the fuck he was, you know, and he came in. And he goes, I want some speakers and a CD player. And I was like, all right. And I knew which were the good CD players. I got him like a Sony CD player. And I said, this has enough amps in it that you can run some 6x9 speakers. And I go, you just put them in the back here. That's a good size speaker, a 6x9, and that'll be good. And then he goes, I can only get it today. And all the fitters were full. And so I said, I went down. There was a 16-year-old apprentice working down there, and I said, mate, this is an easy job, just put the stereo in there, and then I don't know how to fucking do it. I said, and you run the wires along this door panel down here and then just whack those speakers in the side there, just into the side wall, and that'll work, right? Now, you're meant to take the panels off, cut the holes in, put the speakers in, put the panels back on. But this young fella just got the saw out and he just started cutting and it got a bit stiff. Anyway, he cut out one of the support beams that support the roof of the car, and the roof of the car just slanted down, you know, about 45 degrees, just sunk into the thing. And this guy came back to get his car and I just went, okay, well, the good news is the stereo sounds great. And they just I was never felt more terrified in my life than having to walk this bloke down just to show him that we demolished his car in about an hour and a half.
So what happened?
The company had insurance for such occasions. I'm sure we just bought him a new van. There was no way to fix it. You can't put a new support. It's not a panel beating job. We basically cut the roof off his car, you know? So I assume he got a new van out of it. So he probably did pretty good, you know? there was a couple of things like that. I saw a bloke get knocked out changing over. I saw a guy, they had the new BMWs and the European cars had different colored wires and stuff like that. And he was trying to test the fucking, the land and the positive and the negative and the earth and all that type of stuff. And he's got his test out and he's laying in the front seat of the car and he touched the wrong wire. And it was the wire for the airbag and the airbag exploded into his head and he was knocked out and there was just fucking white dust in a bag. Yeah. Anyway, I'm not saying anything that's too bad. That company's gone bust now. They don't exist anymore, so they can't get angry at me for saying anything. Probably because of fucking me.
How did you make the decision to go to the UK? Why the UK as opposed to somewhere else? Is that a usual lily pad for a lot of promising talent from Australia?
Well, the UK has more comedy clubs per capita than anywhere in the world, far beating America. And also, it's just a great place to do comedy because it's so compact. And, you know, I remember before I moved here to America, I used to bitch and moan about, oh, I've got to drive to Manchester, 200-mile drive. You know what I mean? And I used to like, oh, better get a hotel room and stay the night and all that type of stuff. In America, I'm on planes and flying and driving. You know, there's an old saying that that Americans think 100 years is old and British people think 100 miles is far, right? And I think that sort of sums it up, right? But also, if you're under 27 and you're from the Commonwealth, and the people from Canada can do this as well, you can get, and I think it's 1 year now, but back then you can get a two-year work visa where you're allowed to go out and work. Now, you're only meant to do menial jobs. You're meant to be bartenders and whatever. You're not allowed to further your career, you know. So if you walk into any bar in London, it's filled with Australian and New Zealand bartenders, you know. And so I had to do comedy on the sly, cash in hand, until one of the management companies would give me a work permit. But I never became a British citizen or anything. I stayed there for 10 years and my visas would only ever last until my gigs ran out. No one booked you more than 3 months in advance. So every 3 months I went into a panic like, all right, I guess it's all over now. This is the end of the career. You're going back to Australia. And then I got another one and then I got another one. And I just kept on staying. I had a girlfriend there for a bit that I thought I'd marry and thank fuck that didn't work out. You know, I look back on it now, but she was a nice enough girl, but that never happened. And I just kept going. And so what would happen is there was very few American comics in Britain. I feel like it's different now. I feel like the world of comedy is a lot more close. It was much more segregated where everyone was, you know. But all the Canadians and Australians and New Zealanders all hung out together. And we all lived in these houses with like eight comics. And it was good. It was probably, I would argue, the happiest time in my life. I think that would be the happy. And I was broke as fuck, but you know, the rise is always better than the peak, man.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. So, what was it about the rise that you think, just that situation that contributed to feeling happy during that period of time?
Well, it was the optimism, and also you were in it with a group of, you know, people who you all started out with, and you were all supporting each other, and it, you know, the British scene in my mind, is less competitive than the American scene. And I attribute that to, in America, you play a comedy club and the comedy clubs decide who's getting paid what. And so there's a real, you're worth this much, you're worth this much, you're worth this much, right? And so you'll have a headliner who might be being paid $10,000 for that show, and you'll have a support act who's literally getting 40 bucks. And that's wow. still going on, right? And so there is a little bit of like, when you're the person earning the 10,000, like, oh, don't worry, guys, I'll get the drinks. You know what I mean? Like there's a bit of that. But you go down to, I don't know what it is now, but you go down to the Comedy Store in London in the early 2000s, £200 a gig for everybody. And you might do two shows there a night. £200, we'll say like 300 American bucks or thereabouts, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was a good income that you could live off. And, you know, each comic was getting the same price. So you didn't feel like, well, why are they getting this? And I'm not getting this. And if you got famous, you got out of the comedy clubs and you went and did theaters. You never were famous and in comedy clubs, you know? Yeah. And so the comedy clubs might just have your name written out the front, but they don't have posters around the club going, next week, David Spade, next week, Kevin Nealand or whatever, you know what I mean? They don't have that. So people just went to comedy because they wanted to go see comedy, and the club might have a reputation for having the best acts or what have you, and another club might be have a reputation for having worse acts, or maybe they pay less or whatever, you know. But so the fact that no one was sort of getting paid more than anybody else and we were all sort of in the same boat, it didn't breed jealousy or competitiveness like it does over here. And also in America, there seems to be, Britain, there's so few TV opportunities. You know, you might get on a panel show or something like that, but comics getting offered sitcom deals isn't really a thing, you know, because there's not that many sitcoms. There's just not enough channels to do that, you know. And in America, it's like, that guy got a development doing what? How the fuck did this person get it, you know? So that, I think, breeds more jealousy and maybe less kindred spirits than the British one. I think I still have more friends in comedy in the UK than I do in England, in America. But it's coming to say that when I moved to America, I was already sort of established and I was older, and I sort of just keep to myself, to be honest. I like when I'm not doing comedy, to just not think about comedy. And when I was younger, all I did was think about comedy and what do I do? Mm. Jokes. And now I just sort of try not to watch anybody and try to keep to myself and and try to be a good dad and all that type of stuff. And I think that just comes with age.
When did you first feel in, say, the UK that you were successful? And that's relative, right? So it could have been a small win. It could have been a big win. But when did you feel, holy shit, like, I think I'm on my way. This could be a thing.
Well, there's several different stages to that. Now, the first stage is, I didn't have a day job anymore. So I stopped working in the bars and I was working in pubs and stuff when I first got there. I stopped working in bars and then comedy was my full-time job. And that was maybe the best feeling I've had of anything ever, I think. That was the best one, was when this is my job. And you got to the airport and you had to write down occupation in the form, and I got to write stand-up comedian. I still fucking get a little buzz out of doing that, man. I still stand up comedian. And then, you know, the next sort of step, what happened was in Britain, in my opinion, if you weren't doing the Edinburgh Festival, you weren't really trying, you know? And the Edinburgh Festival, unlike Montreal or what have you, or some of the other ones around the world where you're invited to these festivals, you're not invited to Edinburgh. You just decide if you want to do it. And then you go up there and do it. And if people show up, well, that's good for you. But it's a real litmus test on whether people like you or not. Because you went from being in the clubs to you're getting reviewed by 15 or 20 publications. Now, some of these publications are just pissy little student rags that are around for the 3 weeks of the festival. And some of them are the Scotsman and the Telegraph and big, you know, independent and proper newspapers. And so you'd go up to Edinburgh. And so I did one Edinburgh Festival and in a 50-seater, and I averaged 30 tickets a night, and I thought, that's pretty good. And then the next year I went up and I had a 120-seater and I sold that out. And then, afterwards, so then that my management put me into little community centers around the UK to just do solo shows, you know, and little 200-seat community theaters in these small little villages, little towns and villages in between the towns, you know. What happened was, so I was about to my first tour, and then, you know, 2006, and I got punched in the head, and this is before things went viral, or this is before really YouTube is what YouTube was. And then this thing was on everywhere, me getting punched in the head.
Yeah, you mentioned Manchester earlier. It was a Manchester comedy store, right?
It was a Manchester comedy store. And so this little tour I was meant to be doing sold out. And, you know, I've always said that, you know, a lot of people go, oh, that was lucky. But it was, but you still have to be able to back it up, you know, because a lot of opportunities happen to a lot of people. It's whether you're ready to pounce on it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of a bigger moment, you know. And then going off, every time you got to a new festival, and you know, I remember feeling really big the first time someone paid for an airplane ticket for me. I thought, that's something. Yeah. I'm traveling, and I went and did some gigs in Asia, and then I went to Montreal, and I was like, and it was just sitting in economy, but I remember thinking, fuck, and I'm seeing the world for free. And that seemed like a big deal to me, because growing up, my parents saw the world, and they, you know, for 2 years they traveled, and I was always sort of envious of that and thought, I'll never be able to do that. I'll never, you know. And then when I got to do it and stay in nice hotels and that type of stuff, that felt like a real, real achievement, you know. And then everything since then hasn't really felt like anything, to be honest. Nothing, American success or anything's just sort of felt like, now I'm of the opinion that it'll all go away one day. It'll all end, or it won't be what it is now. And you got to be happy without it, you know. If you're not happy with it, you won't be happy without it. So that's why I'm saying the rise was better than the thing. Now it's like, oh, all right, when's this going to end? And then when you're younger, you're like, the sky's the limit. And now it's like, oh, I don't need to go up any higher. I've seen enough. I've seen enough of the sky.
What keeps you going these days, right? I would agree that the sort of chasing the summit is in a lot of ways more fun than getting up there and being like, Jesus Christ, okay, now what?
Well, now it's more about, less about success and more about making good work, you know? Doing like it's also things now. It's like, so I'm doing a multicam sitcom now. If you asked me even a year ago if I'd ever do a multicam sitcom, I'd think no one would ever put me in a multicam sitcom. And then when I got asked it, some of the fan base were calling me a sellout and all that type of stuff because I'm doing a multicam. And it's like, you know what? Fuck you, man. It's like, I watched Seinfeld. I watched Friends. I watched Cheers. I watch all these things. I love those shows. There's a rumor about these shows that, oh, but they have a laugh track. They don't have a laugh track. It's a fucking studio audience. People are actually laughing. That's real laughter, you know, but it seemed to be a bit cheap or something. But, you know, I think now is challenging myself is what you want to do, you know. So I'm not a good actor. Sometimes I get better at it the more I do it, you know what I mean? I'd like to get good at acting. I think that would be a thing that would be, you know, I would never have the audacity to call myself an actor. I say stand-up comedian / actor, and I always think I should take that bit off the actor bit. You know, cause that's not a real thing. But yeah, because I know real actors. I've got some friends who are proper actors, and they're a complete class difference from what I can do. Every job, like in legit, I played myself. You know, I'm going to play myself in this sitcom. It's like I'm not really an actor as such as someone who just reads the lines as myself.
Well, let's talk about, you mentioned getting better at acting. Let's talk about comedy for a second and flashback to Edinburgh. So for people who want a picture, Edinburgh is this extremely picturesque town.
Beautiful city.
It's beautiful. City. You've got the coffee shops where J.K. Rowling wrote the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
I didn't know that. Is she from Edinburgh? There you go.
She wrote a number of the books there. I think at the Elephant Room, and then like beautiful fudge, kind of looks like Hogwarts. You can see all these buildings.
Yeah.
What happens, just since I don't know anything about the festival, if it's not invite only, what happens if too many comics show up? Or is it just so intimidating that that doesn't happen? And do you just kind of walk into town like with a stick and a satchel over your shoulder?
There's just unlimited rooms. There's just unlimited. They go to the university, they use every single classroom. They'll find any, like they'll find a closet and go, this is a 4-seat room. There's half of these rooms are complete and utter fire hazards. They shouldn't be allowed. Like, and it's in the middle of summer and people are sweltering. There's people fainting in your audience and stuff like that. And then there's the biggest room's 1,000 seats, which is McEwen Hall. But then they do things like, they put tents up. So there's a lot of park areas, and they just whack tents up everywhere and people perform in these tents. And what happens is these venues will start operating at 9 in the morning and they'll be running at 4 in the morning, right?
Wow.
And each hour is someone's act. And so, you know, when like my first show, I got like a 11 o'clock PM spot, which isn't a great spot. You want that sort of 6 to 9 sort of area. And then like, as you get more popular, they go, oh, you've got the 8 o'clock spot. And you're like, ooh, the 8 o'clock spot. You know what I mean? So that, like, I heard something, 2,000 shows are up at the festival.
That's too. Incredible.
And it's not just stand-up comedy. Stand-up comedy, for whatever reason, is the bit that people, it's known for, but it's an arts festival. So there's a lot of cool things. Like during the day, there's a lot of shows that you can see that you can take your kids to, something, some puppetry or some type of clowning type thing, or a lot of stand-up comics who are more family friendly, they might do their adult show at night and they'll do a kid show during the day, you know, which is a cool thing. And I never could. I was always hungover and sleep until 5 p.m. and then I'd crawl out and do my show. I used to gain like 20 pounds at that festival, you know, and then work it all. Just beer weight, just horrible fat, you know. Anyway, but it's for me, it's a magical place. It more than any other festival, because it was just everybody up there was creative and it was people that wanted to do their things, and people, comics were experimenting that they couldn't do in comedy clubs. There was things that I was doing that I did a story that was 40 minutes long about taking my friend with muscular dystrophy to a brothel. And the thing about that is I'd never done a set in a comedy club that was more than 20 minutes. So I couldn't have done that routine if not for the Edinburgh Festival, even if I wanted to, you know? But the thing is, I think the average loss is £5,000. It's your own money, and the promoters are making money, and there's posters everywhere, right? And then you got to pay for the posters. Then you got to pay for people to fly for you all day, or you got to fly for yourself. And so if you break even on that festival, if you come out like going, yeah, zero, that's, you really crushed it. You really crushed it. And so it's a gamble. But the thing is, you get reviewers, you get media. There's things like, what's her name? Fleabag. You know, Phoebe Waller, she just wrote the last James Bond movie. And she had a TV, she won an Emmy for a TV show, Fleabag.
Okay, got it. I'll try to find her. We'll put it in the show notes.
Anyway, like her show.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Is that the one?
Phoebe Waller-Bridge, right? So her show was just a show at the Edinburgh Festival that some BBC executive saw and went, well, make it into a TV show. And then all of a sudden, you got a TV show. Then she's got an American TV. And now she's fucking writing James Bond. And that magic doesn't happen out of a comedy club. It just doesn't, you know? And so, you know, like the Edinburgh Festival gave us Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie, you know, they won one of the first awards, and all these great sketch groups that, you know, I don't think Monty Python ever did it, but maybe they did. I don't know.
Well, let's
I'm a huge Python guy.
You are.
I had John Cleese came over to my house for dinner, and I was just fanboying out the whole time, and it was the fucking best, man. It was the best. I'm friends with his daughter, and they were going to come and see one of my shows. And then because this is the early stages of quarantine, before everyone was quarantined, but we were canceling live things. It was like the first week. And so my show was canceled, And he was going to come, and I said, oh, we'll just come over for dinner. And then I just was like, fucking John Cleese is in my house, man. That was that was one of the great thrills of my life.
If for people who don't have, and this is true, I think, of a lot of younger people who might be listening to this from the US, if they don't have exposure to Monty Python, where would you suggest they start?
Well, it's very easy at the moment because I think Netflix has all of it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Netflix has all of it. I think the easiest, the most palatable thing to, okay, so the best movie is The Life of Brian, but maybe if you just want to have something that's like easy, palatable, and I think they think it's their worst film, I'd watch The Meaning of Life first because it's small sketches and it's easy to watch. I'm not a big Holy Grail or Jabberwocky fan. I like The Life of Brian, but The Flying Circus Show is as good as anything, and all of those are on Netflix and they're ready to watch. You know, all the sketches are good. They're all good. It's just like the classic ones like The Dead Parrot and all that type of stuff, they're not even the best ones. They're just the most easy to quote, I think.
Yeah.
They're not even the best ones.
Well, let's talk about your brothel visit with your friend with muscular dystrophy.
Sure.
All right. So Edinburgh Festival, it's a big opportunity. How do you work on that material? Like, what did you do to get that ready? That's a big set. Yeah.
Well, that routine pretty much has the story. You have stories that are partly true and stories that you embellish and stories that you add on things and, you know, but that story is very, very close to 100% true. Very close. And what happened there was I had my friend, his brother, wanted to get a blowjob. We sorted it out. And then, you know, the story happened. And then I remember when that happened, I was actually at the Melbourne Comedy Festival, which I've only done once. I went into the bar, the comedian's bar in Melbourne, and I literally walked in. I saw a couple of friends of mine, and I said, have I got a story for you? And I remember I started telling it. By the time I was halfway through the story, there was maybe 11 people standing around in this bar, and people were saying, turn the music down. Right. And I was talking about this brothel visit, and I remember thinking, wow, this is keeping comedians' attention, you know. And I think I probably told that story to in pubs and to friends for about a year, and before it just became just a standard bit of a comedy for me. And then from that, the TV show Legit is from, you know, at an FX TV show, which was completely based on that story. And it was that was just the pilot episode, was taking someone to a brothel, like with muscular dystrophy, to a brothel. And then when we did the show afterwards, we did another 26 episodes. And the thing that was weird was then you have a character with muscular dystrophy that you have to write into each episode. And I thought, oh God, I only really need this guy for one. But then that became the sweetness of the show. That became the sweet thing. But it was hard. Sometimes you'd write a funny scene or something funny would happen in your life and you'd think, oh, I got to put that in the show. And then you go, and I have to work in a guy in a wheelchair.
How do you, and I apologize, I'm not a comic, so I don't even know the proper vocabulary. We have, I think we have some mutual friends like Whitney Cummings and Brian Callen and these guys who will have much more pointed questions. But for lack of a better way to ask, how do you workshop some of your more, I was going to say intricate, but just longer pieces, for instance? And I know you get asked about this all the time, but if we look at the gun control or gun-related pieces that you've done, I mean, those are like long theatrical pieces.
Well, I have an interesting story on how I wrote Gun Control.
Let's hear it.
That routine, I think that probably is the routine I'm most proud about. I think it's the most sort of thought-provoking or original or whatever thing that I did was that Gun Control routine that I think is most memorable. And sadly, the routine always gets new legs after there's a shooting or something like that. So it's not the way you want to get known, you know, but That routine. Now I have to stipulate when I say this. Okay, with Americans, I understand that many of you like guns, and I'm not anti you. I don't think you're wrong. I do think you're wrong. but I grew up in a society without guns, and I have had a different life experience from you. And so this is just my point of view. It doesn't mean that my point of view is right and your point of view is wrong. It's just this is my way of thinking on the matter. So I have a guy, and I'm happy to call this man a friend, who does not agree with me in any way. And this guy is more Republican than I'm. I'm more moderate. I think people think I'm a big lefty, but I'm a bit more moderate than I think people would realize. And it's John Ratzenberg from Cheers.
No kidding.
Cliff Clavin from Cheers. And Cliff Clavin was on my TV show, Legit. And I was with him when Sandy Hook happened. And we were on set, and he said to me, Jimmy, if only these teachers had guns, we wouldn't have these problems. And I went, you're fucking kidding. You want teachers to have guns? And we argued and debated for a few days on this matter. You know, it was never mean or nasty or anything like that. It was just, you know, I couldn't believe that Americans thought this way about guns. Before that, I always knew you liked guns. But when I heard these arguments, and I was saying to other people, this guy at work, you wouldn't believe what he said. It's fucking crazy. And then I started finding out that other people who were friends of mine agreed with him as well. And I thought, oh man, maybe I'm not in the minority, but this is a very common belief they all have. And so then you start thinking, maybe I'm wrong or maybe I'm whatever. And so I just wanted to give not a scientific or a statistic-based argument on the guns. I just wanted to give my point of view and just looking at it rationally type of argument, you know? So that routine was written through arguments with other people. It was just, conversations with other people. It wasn't written by me going, oh, and I wonder what the statistic is on this, and I wonder what that is, and reading and researching. It was me just arguing with friends. Until I got all my arguments down and I was like, all right, this is what I'm coming in with. And very often, stand-up comedy is just you having a one-sided argument and no one being able to respond, which is a wonderful thing. They all respond in the end. They all write something at the end on the internet and try to get you, or they come up to you. But and in that moment on stage, your argument is gospel and no one can say any different. Doesn't mean it's right.
And as you're having these arguments, are you refining all of this in your head, just catching it in a net, or do you have a little black book you pull out of your pocket when something comes up? How do you capture it?
I don't write jokes down, and I really should, because I lose track of punchlines and stuff like that, and other lines can seep in. I should write things down, but I never fucking write things down. I do most of me writing on stage. You have a kernel of a thought, and you wait till you're doing a gig where you're really cooking and the audience really likes you, and you think, oh, I can get away with anything right now. And then you do your bit, and if it doesn't work, you go straight back into a bit that's you know really well. It's very solid. And so that's how I do it on stage. And a lot of people in LA, they'll invite you to do a gig and they'll say, hey, come down to my room and try out. It's a good place to try out new stuff. And it's like, are you fucking out of your mind? I'm going to come down, do 10 minutes and try out new stuff in LA where someone important might be. I wedge the joke in Kansas in my 2 hour show in the middle of, you know, when you're doing 2 hours on stage, I try to work in 2 new minutes each time, 3 new minutes. And then that 3 minutes becomes 5 minutes. And then at the end of a year, you've got a new show. That's why I always find it weird that you're expected to have a new tour written, when really these tours are, if you see me a year and a half apart, it'll be a new show. But if you see me, even if it's a different tour and it's a month apart, it's not going to be that much different, because everything's just evolving and moving and turning. And then the specials come out. And once the special comes out, you never say those jokes again.
And when you try out those new 2 or 3 minutes, if it really works, or it partially works, do you just make a mental note? Do you go back and watch the video or listen to tape?
Yeah, I don't tape them either. I'm normally so focused on those 2-3 minutes that I know that you know, I know what I'm going to do. But the 2 or 3 minutes, sometimes that works better than the stuff that's killer, even though it's not as good a joke, because for whatever reason, the audience can see that you're excited by that joke and they can see the sparkle behind your eye. And there's that little bit of magic that happens because you're so excited, and you can't fake that. And you can't act excited about a joke you've told 100 times. You can't. Mm-hmm. You can perform it well. You can perform it really well. You can put everything into it and make it great, but you can never have that magic where you're grinning through it because you're like, ah, oh, this is so good. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. so because doing a new bit of stand-up, that's the most enjoyable bit of the whole show for the performer, or at least it is for me.
Life of Brian. So let's come back to that, if you don't mind. What is sure. it about Life of Brian that makes it so good in your mind?
Well, it's the perfect movie. The thing about it is there's plenty of quotable sort of sketches in there and stuff like that. It's mocking religion, which I love, but it's also not mocking religion in a direct way. It's like the Christians can get upset and go, this is sacrilege and that type of stuff. No, they don't tease Jesus at all. You know what I mean? They have the beginning, the meek, they will inherit this and inherit that, but they don't really get into Jesus. We're talking about Brian. If you want to say that this is about Jesus, that's your fucking problem. You know, there's a lot of people going around acting like they were the prophets who got crucified back in the day. And if you want to say that we can't talk about them, that seems a bit ridiculous. So it's a lovely little loophole where you can poke fun at people and still, you know, and also that stuff about the, what did the Romans ever do for us? The aqueduct, the this, that. It's just, it's very, very funny.
Are there any other comics who were really formative for you, or people you have formative, or people you've looked at and just said to yourself, I don't know how they do what they do, right? Because I guess those are two separate things, I suppose.
George Carlin, when I started watching him, I thought that he was pretty amazing. And I get a little bit Carlin-esque on a joke here and there, and I got to watch myself because I'd love to have been that man. You know, he seems like the perfect comedian to me. I would say there was a guy called Anthony Morgan as well when I was growing up in Australia who was very influential on me growing up. And I don't know what he does these days, and I haven't seen him since, but he was a big deal for me. And Eddie Murphy's Delirious was a pivotal moment in my childhood. It was the first time I saw someone who wasn't Australian doing stand-up comedy. Got to understand, in Australia, we only had 4 TV channels. We had no comedy specials. I didn't know Richard Pryor was a comedian. I thought he was an actor. Right? Yeah. We had no stand-up specials. We had no HBO. That didn't exist. We didn't even have American TV. I couldn't see who was doing well on Carson. That didn't exist. Those clips never got to us. You know, we had our own late night shows with our own comics on them, and you'd see them for a few minutes, and that was all you really saw of them. And then Delirious was the first cinematic release stand-up special. So it was in the video store. And I remember watching it, and I couldn't get over that this guy was doing stand-up comedy for an hour. That blew my mind. I thought the stand-up comedy was only in a medium of 5 minutes. That's what everyone did. And then you couldn't watch someone afterwards. And I remember, like, I wasn't good looking. I wasn't good at sports. I wasn't anything, you know, that was deemed to be cool. You know, I couldn't play on a guitar. I couldn't, you know, and just to see someone who was doing something that I believed I had the innate talent to be able to do, and he was cool. You know what I mean? I'd never seen, yeah. like, because comedy before that, before Eddie Murphy for me, we're goofy people. And I still to this day don't particularly care my mother always used to go, those kids at school are laughing at you, not with you. And I just didn't care as long as I was getting the laughs, because I still knew I was doing it to get laughs. It didn't matter to me where they came from. And so just to see someone who was cool and he was, you know, like, let's be honest, I wear a fucking leather jacket on all my specials because fucking Eddie Murphy wore those leather jumpsuits. There's one of my specials, I wear it without a t-shirt. I just wanted to just once have a leather. And I've never done that in my personal life or anything. And just before I walked out on stage, I went, fuck it, I'm taking the t-shirt off. I'm going to be like Eddie Murphy and just wear a leather jacket on bare skin. That jacket stinks to this day.
Do you think you'll still be in LA, or is LA home base for you in 10 years' time?
LA's home, and LA's home, and I don't believe that, you know, I got a kid, and I would like to have another child sometime. So I think when you have children, I think that's your moving's done. You know what I mean? I think maybe I could retire in Hawaii or something like that. And depending if my kid fucking goes off and works in New York or whatever, what's the point of me staying in LA? You know, maybe I could go off to Santa Barbara and buy a place and go for fucking walks or whatever the fuck people do when they're old. But, you know, you could be in a lot worse places than LA. There's nothing wrong with it. Now, I really get a bit home proud of LA, and I don't like when people bag on it. Yeah. When people just go, oh, LA, oh, you must hate it there. And they're like, oh, the traffic. Where I live doesn't have traffic because your place is shit. LA's got traffic. LA's got traffic because people want to fucking live here. That's why there's traffic, because people want to be here. And it's good. And the food's good, and the women are pretty and shit. You know what I mean? Like, why would you... You know what I mean? Why would you want to fucking, the restaurants are nice. Like there's places, other places that are nice as well, but there's just, what my argument is, there's nothing wrong with LA.
Well, LA is also, I mean, this took me a while to figure out. Obviously there are many people who spent more time there, but I lived in Northern California for almost 20 years and spent a lot of time in Southern California, is that LA to me strikes me like as if it's a dozen different cities all within the umbrella of LA, right? So you can really kind of pick your pocket depending on where you want to be, and the personalities are very different.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. It's like when I moved to LA, all I knew of LA was two things. There was the Hollywood, which was the ritzy looking lights and all that type of stuff. And then there was Compton. And they're the only two things that I had seen on TV. You know what I mean? And so I used to think, I used to believe I couldn't walk the streets in LA because a Blood or a Crip would come and shoot me or something. You know what I mean? Like there'd be a drive-by or something. It's fucking, or I'd be in Beverly Hills and it would just be girls with long legs with dogs in handbags. And I thought that was all there was. And it turns out, there's also the Valley.
What do you think, I won't keep you too much longer, but and we're definitely going to talk about the podcast, but what has helped you to have longevity in comedy? Because it seems like you have some longevity. Yeah.
I think it's producing a lot of specials. I think bringing out the specials constantly sort of keep you going. The specials I never like do a special and then it's like, wow, you're more popular now or anything like that. But it just keeps your fan base going. And I think you gotta give a product. You know, you've got to keep touring. You gotta, you know, if you keep your eye off the ball, then I'm not a big believer in that. I'm in competition with anybody else. I just think, if I just keep on producing good quality stuff, I'll always have a fan base, whether it be small or large or whatever. There'll be somebody somewhere that wants to pay to watch me tell jokes, you know. So, but as I said, if it all ends tomorrow and I just become like an old fella who sits around showing my kid pictures like, one time I played the tennis arena in Melbourne. You know what I mean? Like, I think I'm all right with that too. I don't know. I don't know what the secret to being a successful comic is. I really couldn't tell you. If I could tell you, I'd go manage comedians and stop doing it myself.
When you think back to the filling in of the customs form with stand-up comedian and the high that that gave you when you first did it, not that it would be the same magnitude of high, it could be, but like what gives you that type of high now or in the last handful of years, or what are you hoping to do that would give you that type of hit?
I think if I was in a dramatic movie, that would be something. That's something that right now I can't foresee ever happening. So that would be one thing that would surprise me if that happened, because that's not on the horizon. No one's ever asked or asked if I'm interested or anything like that. So if that happened, that would be something that would shock me if that happened. And, you know, I don't suspect it will happen, but if that happened, it would shock me. But, you know, it might sound corny. The thing I get the most joy out of is probably being a dad. I really like being a dad. I think I'm more proud of when I do that well than when I do comedy well.
How do you know when you're being a good dad?
That's the thing, man. That's the thing. You don't know. I know my son really loves me, and that's cool. Yeah, I know that. And then you do things where just little things, you know, you teach a kid to ride a bike and you're like, yeah, I did it. Cause you know, as a parent, I don't know how to like my son's still having problems doing his shoelaces, and I feel like I've let him down a bit there. He's getting a bit old. he's getting a bit old and he should be able to do it. And I feel like, hey, I dropped the ball on that one.
Is he 18, 19? I mean, how's he?
No, he's seven. He's seven.
Okay, all right, just checking.
He's seven, but I've read that he should have been able to do it by the time he was six, and he's hopeless at it. You know, he gives it a go, and then I go, but because I keep buying him fucking shoes with Velcro on them, you know what I mean? So I feel like that's lazy parenting where I've stuffed up a little bit, you know. But you know, you take them on a good holiday, or you work hard and you get them into a good school and you do all those type of things. And I feel like, all right, because otherwise what's all this for if you're not going to give the next generation a better life than you had?
Yeah. Yeah, thinking about kids for the first time really for me in the last 18 months or so. So it's I have a newfound interest in talking to people who are parents, but I don't want to belabor that. I don't want to turn this into a therapy session too quickly. So let's talk about the new podcast. I don't know about that. Why this show?
I think no offense to you, I think there's enough shows where people are interviewing people. You know what I mean?
I agree with that.
yeah. And you talk about what there definitely is. There's far too many comedians interviewing comedians. Like it seems like a very weird thing now that we all go on each other's podcasts and we talk about how we get started and how to write a joke and all that type of stuff. And then I thought How Do Things Work or The More You Know and all those type of podcasts where they talk about stuff. Those are the ones that I sort of was interested in, where I was like, I started listening to less comedy podcasts and more podcasts where I could learn something. And then those crime ones, everyone likes those so much because they have something they learn about. Now, this also goes back to my father is a very difficult man to argue with, because if you prove him wrong, and like he'll say, oh, this happened, that happened, and you're bloody this and that, and me, blah, 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 blah. And then you go, well, Dad, that's not actually true, you know, like because in 1948, the government did blah, 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 blah. You say that, and you give him facts, and then my father just goes, well, I don't know about that. And that's not conceding. That's just going, oh, maybe you're right. I doubt it. You know what I mean? So I thought, well, what the podcast is what will happen is each podcast will have a specialist on, somebody who knows a lot about a subject, whether they've written a book or they've done a TED talk on it or whatever the fuck, and they'll come on and I won't know who they are or what they do, and then they have to say their topic of expertise, and then I will say everything that I think I know about that thing, right? Because do you remember before the internet, when you had a guy in a bar who you used to think was the smartest person ever, and then the internet came out and you could just Google things and it turned out he was completely full of shit, right?
Right.
I'm going to be that guy, right? And then at the end, the guy, the person, the specialist will tell me, what I got right, what I got wrong, what misinformation I had, what is a common bit of misinformation on the thing. And then we'll all learn together about these specialist topics and we'll keep it funny and we'll keep it light. And then at the end of the thing, you'll know about a topic.
I love it. What are some of the topics on the slate?
I don't know. I don't know.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So, what have you recorded so far? If you can give people a sort of a preview, or maybe you don't want to. We can go either way.
I think I can. Can we name a couple, Alex? Or yeah, we did the war on drugs, and we've done earthquakes. We've done like four or five of these, but that's a couple. We did earthquakes and the war on drugs. And now I know shitloads about earthquakes and the war on drugs. I know a lot of stuff now. But before, I didn't know much.
Well, I love the format. I mean, I do agree with you. I think there's an overabundance of interview style formats, and who knows, I may end up looking at the photos, reminiscing on the old days, and I'd be okay with that too at some point. If
you're one of the bigger ones, Tim, I think you'll be just fine.
Yeah, I think it'll be fine, but you know, there might be a time to take old Yeller behind the shed and put him to rest. I love your comedy. I think you're a smart guy.
You.
It's very, very thought provoking, as I mentioned at the very beginning. The new podcast is I Don't Know About That, which is debuting Tuesday, May 5th. And I'm sure people can find more about it on jimjeffries.com. You can be found on Twitter, Instagram, @JimJeffries. Is there anything else you'd like to share or anywhere else that people can?
No, man. Just subscribe to the new podcast. All my gigs are canceled because I have no shows to promote. But hopefully after this quarantine's all over, I'll be coming to a city near you. Thanks for having me, Tim.
Oh, my pleasure. And I will, for everybody listening, link to I Don't Know About That, link to some of the episodes we mentioned, the Manchester head-punching incident, a couple of the clips and bits, as well as TV shows, everything in the show notes, as usual, at tim.blog/podcast. And Jim, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, mate. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And to everybody listening, till next time, thanks for tuning in.
Hey guys, this is Tim again. Just a few more things before you take off. Number one, this is 5 Bullet Friday. Do you want to get a short email from me? Would you enjoy getting a short email from me every Friday that provides a little morsel of fun before the weekend? And 5 Bullet Friday is a very short email where I share the coolest things I've found or that I've been pondering over the week. That could include favorite new albums that I've discovered. It could include gizmos and gadgets and all sorts of weird shit that I've somehow dug up in the world of the esoteric as I do. It could include favorite articles that I've read and that I've shared with my close friends, for instance. And it's very short. It's just a little tiny bite of goodness before you head off for the weekend. So if you want to receive that, check it out. Just go to 4hourworkweek.com. That's 4hourworkweek.com, all spelled out, and just drop in your email and you will get the very next one. And if you sign up, I hope you enjoy it.
This episode is brought to you by Laird Superfood. I love this company. I love their products. I just got a huge box delivered yesterday for a re-up because I always keep it in stock. And many of you have asked me about intermittent fasting, so I'll touch on that in a second. Founded by big wave surfer Laird Hamilton, and really one of the kings of big wave surfing, and volleyball champion Gabby Reese, Laird Superfood promises to deliver high-impact fuel to help you get through your busiest days. And I can speak from experience, having worked out with both Laird and Gabby. These are people you want to emulate. They're just incredible physical specimens, and their combination of performance and longevity is unlike perhaps anything I've ever seen elsewhere. Laird Superfood offers a line of plant-based products designed to optimize your daily rituals from sunrise to sunset. My favorite two products that I put in just about everything are their turmeric superfood creamer and the unsweetened superfood creamer. And a $10 bag of either of these will last you a really long time. So the bang for the buck is incredible. Both can really optimize your daily coffee or tea ritual. I really put them in any warm beverage that I make for myself. And that's where the intermittent fasting comes in. So if I'm going to skip meals, I really like to use some of either the unsweetened or the turmeric superfood creamer.
they are packed with, among other things, a full range of MCTs, that's medium chain triglycerides, to help keep you and your brain going from AM to PM. So that's part one. They're also packed with real ingredients like organic extra virgin coconut oil, coconut milk, and aquamin, and they come in all sorts of flavors, including cacao and, as I mentioned, turmeric. You just have to stir them. You don't really need any instrument for that. You can just do it with a spoon. You could power froth if you have a little frother, or blend otherwise into your cup of coffee, for instance, for a nourishing and energizing superfood latte you can feel good about using to kickstart your day. It's also, for me, an affordable indulgence, right? Because black coffee, I love black coffee, but after having 1,000 cups of black coffee at home, I just want a change. And so to feel like I'm having a decadent cappuccino of sorts, plus brain fuel on top of that, really can make the difference in winning the morning for me. So Laird Superfood, they understand that food is fuel, and the better fuel you have, the harder and further you can go. This is an easy and inexpensive way to really add some octane to your mornings and amplify your daily rituals. They have a diverse product line, including superfood creamers, as I mentioned, the two that are my favorite, turmeric and unsweetened, delicious hydration solutions, and much more. For a limited time, Laird Superfood is offering you guys, my listeners, 20% off of your order when you use code TIM at checkout. Check out LairdSuperfood.com. That's LAIRD. LairdSuperfood.com/Tim to see my favorite products and learn more. Again, that's LairdSuperfood.com/Tim and use code TIM for 20% off of your order. One more time, take a look. I use this stuff all the time and I recommend trying it out. LairdSuperfood.com/Tim, promo code TIM.